Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Monday, May the 28th, and we observe Memorial Day today. And we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. And this is going to be a big topic we're going to get into today with Bill. Memorial Day, and particularly the ignorance of so many Americans when it comes to U.S. history. It is really frightening. How can you have a future when so many people don't know their past? So we'll get into that quite a bit with Bill today. President Trump in North Korea, I think it's going to go on. I think it's going to happen, but this is all part of the theatrics of it. Bill had an interesting post about James Clapper and Michael Hayden. They're having a little debate, if you will, and this whole thing about Spygate gets more confusing every day. I don't know what to believe anymore on this Spygate. Germany is apparently a little bit confused with the Iran nuclear deal. And Bill wrote a very interesting post about that. It seems like Germany just wants money out of Iran. Nuclear deal or nuclear missiles, well, they don't care too much about that. There was a very ugly incident down in Florida, and once again we see the face of a young man, Dave Hogg, H-O-G-G. He was one of the young men who became famous, I guess, because of the Parkland high school shooting, and while we certainly cut this young man and many other young people down there a lot of slack in what they went through, it certainly does not support his behavior recently, and so we'll get into that. It looks like Pelosi has become the GOP number one enemy. All they have to do is remind people that she's going to be the next speaker, and all of a sudden people are thinking Republican. Ireland approved an abortion law. What I found just remarkable was the reaction of some people. You would have thought that Ireland just won its independence or something. I mean, I just thought some of the reaction, frankly, was over the top. And we do point out that President Bush, 41, is back in the hospital, not doing well. So we send our prayers to President Bush and everyone in his family. Let me say hello from a very pretty Memorial Day here in Dallas, Texas, to our friend Bill Katz. How are you, Bill?
Well, just fine this morning, Silvio. It's a getting to be a nice day in New York after a miserable one yesterday. And we'll look around today for Memorial Day commemorations. I don't know how many there will be. It certainly is a different picture than my youth, where Memorial Day really was Memorial Day. I mean, we would have a Memorial Day commemoration in our town. It was considered a solemn day. You could also have your family over. I mean, nobody was objecting to that, but I don't even know if there's going to be one in my town. It's a very depressing picture. You do see some good news coverage. I think Fox did some very good news coverage of commemorations at different cemeteries. But I think we are losing that notion of a devotion to those who devoted themselves, and I think it's a very sad state of affairs.
I wonder, and you wrote about this at Urgent Agenda, and I want to get into it a little bit with you today, because I wonder how much of this has to do with the fact that it's highly unlikely for a young person today to know someone who served, number one, or obviously was killed in war. Now, I happen to know two young people in our area, one very well, and the other one I didn't know. I knew him, but I didn't know his family. The first one was a young man at our church, Nathan Aguirre, who was killed in 2006 in Iraq. And in fact, I was with his father the morning that he got the news that his son had been killed. I was with his father when he and I were ushers at the 11 o'clock mass. And so when I said goodbye to him and I said, hey, we'll see you next Sunday, little did I realize that as he drove home with his wife, there were a couple of people there waiting for him to tell him the news that Nathan had been killed. So that at least is close to me. I also know people, not friends of mine, but indirectly, who were killed in Vietnam. So it seems like it means something, because I know someone who's actually buried because of dying in war. But I wonder how many young people have that connection, Bill. You know, we were talking off the air about this new generation. What have we asked of them other than maybe to upgrade their iPhones, Bill?
I mean, that's a wonderful way of putting it. You know, I have an actress friend who is very bright, a woman, a Juilliard graduate, and who likes to discuss this subject. And she also teaches. And I asked her about young people today, and she said, one of the problems with young people today is they've never seen strife, real strife. They think they have. You know, if somebody disagrees with you on where the desk will be placed in an office, they consider that strife. But past generations have seen so much, as you said, up close. They've seen it. The World War II generation, and they weren't perfect people. Nobody's claiming they were perfect people, but they had gone through the Depression, which was horrible enough. Young people today have no conception of what it is like to have a community that is dying because there are no jobs, where people can't afford basic food, where the social services and social programs were far less than they are today. And to go through that and then to immediately be hit by World War II. We had millions of kids in World War II who had come from poor homes where they already had a very difficult upbringing and then had to fight a war. And these kids know nothing of things like that. Nothing. It's just they call themselves marginalized on college campuses. Kids at Ivy League schools with full scholarships call themselves marginalized. They tell you about all the pain they suffer if someone doesn't appreciate their culture. Mm-hmm. For goodness sake, I think of my own ancestors coming to this country in the 1890s and early part of the 20th century, where there were no social programs of any kind, where survival was itself difficult, working in sweatshops.
Right.
Any one of them would have given their existence for the existence of some of these kids today. And the kids have no sense of appreciation, and it's not their fault. They were never taught.
Right. No, and they don't, as you say, they don't. They, you know, I know that it's always been traditional for the older or the adult generation to look back and say, oh, you know, you don't know what life is, you know, you have it so easy. And to some extent, I mean, my parents used to do that to me, and I'm sure every generation does that. But today, it is true. I mean, my three sons are really three very nice young men who are three a credit to the country. They're doing very well. But what have they gone through of any significant consequence? I mean, have they gone through a war? No. Have they gone through a depression? No. Did they go through what my parents went through, having the secret police knock at your door at 2 o'clock in the morning, asking you a bunch of questions? I mean, these experiences that we went through, they haven't. And I'm just wondering if it's going to take a major conflict where we have to draft 100,000 young men overnight, if it's going to take something like that for these young people to wake up, or if we do have to draft them, are they capable of serving, given how soft they are? I mean, some of these people are so soft, Bill, that it makes you wonder if they can take anything, any difficulty, Bill.
Well, it certainly, when you hear the bad stories coming out of college campuses where they need safe spaces to protect themselves against ideas they disagree with, you wonder, first of all, at their maturity level. The maturity level seems so low. Now, from what mm-hmm. I understand, it's sometimes hard to get really correct information from college campuses, but that this is the people who do this are not a majority, that they are actually a very loud minority. There was the story that was told just yesterday about a young woman who graduated from Mount Holyoke, which is a distinguished women's college in Massachusetts, and she is a conservative, and she's a Trump supporter, and she says that at her graduation she was booed, and that she as these kids do, they turn on their iPhones or whatever that they have during these ceremonies, and they communicate with each other, and she says that people were sending her awful texts, hateful texts, because she's a conservative. But she made sure to say this is not a large number, but they are very noisy. But, you know, all it takes is 10% of frightening people to really suppress a community. And I think that's what we're seeing on college campuses. I cannot believe that a majority of college students is this bad, but I think that a majority is intimidated by these people. There are some signs, some very positive signs, that are coming today from college campuses, and I emphasize them because they're so influential in the country. These are going to be your leaders in 20 years. And there are, just in the last 4 weeks, there were signs at Brown University and Harvard, both of which are Ivy League schools, of students demanding more intellectual diversity, more conservative voices. That's a very good sign. That's something we didn't see. There
right.
was an educator named Jonathan Haidt, who was here in New York, who is a nominal conservative, who said there is change coming. He said it may not be this year, but he believes by next year there will be in place real movements toward greater sanity, greater responsibility on college campuses. And we may be seeing the first signs of that. So I wouldn't despair completely, but for goodness sakes, we have a young generation, as my actress friend said, they've never seen strife. And as for the wars we fight, it's somebody else's war. Mm-hmm. And that began during Vietnam with the terrible handling of personnel policy during the Vietnam War. Now, Americans didn't even think it was their war. It was some kid in the city. He was doing the fighting. So
right.
why should we care that much? And today, with the volunteer military, where people are not drafted into the military, we have a separate military class, and that's a dangerous thing in a democracy.
It is, because that did not happen in World War II, of course, and that's the reason I think that everybody in World War II knew what was going on, because your neighbor's son was fighting somewhere, generally.
That's right.
And that's
or
not
your
the
son.
Case, right?
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And that of course made it very close to home. But I do think that, like, obviously because of my son's ages, I meet a lot of young people, and on the whole, you don't feel that bad. At least when I meet their friends, I see successful young men who are, who I feel are okay. But then when you follow the news and you see a student being interviewed at a university who somehow wants to change the mascot from the Colonials because she's offended, I guess,
yes.
by that. It just makes you wonder, what in the world are we teaching? I mean, I would have expected the teachers in that school, the professors in that school, to call in that young woman and say, look, let me give it to you straight. You're full
yes.
of, you know what?
Yes,
I mean,
well, the teachers are on their side. It's the teachers who are teaching them this stuff.
Right.
We have a general. I mean, look at the statistics on political beliefs of college professors. It's so overwhelmingly on the left. You wonder how anybody can get a real education. And if the kids invite a conservative speaker, that speaker is often shouted down, or is often blocked, or is harassed. UCLA has just come out with a policy where they're putting a dollar figure on the amount of security that can be spent every year for speakers. Meaning, now the only speakers who need security are conservative speakers. Liberal speakers never need security. You don't find
no.
conservatives shouting them down. So what they're
no.
basically saying is we're going to limit the number of conservative speakers. And they think this is perfectly okay. And one reason they think it's so okay is that on the left today, which is what dominates the colleges, the universities, and now increasingly high schools, on the left today is an attitude that we are better people. We should have, in effect, more rights because we're the good people. You hear that from them all the time. It's a dangerous attitude. It really is. It's an attitude that gets dictatorship started. And I think I think we're in danger
yeah.
if we. But I think the American people, in their practicality, will start to fight back. I think you see it already. But what concerns me is that the people who have brought us to this position are often followers of radical politics and of radical ideology, and one part of the radical ideology is to accuse your opponent of doing what you're doing yourself and to take positions of your opponent temporarily to deceive them into believing that you're really with them. And that's what worries me about, for example, the Democratic Party claiming to be so tough on Russia. Or Chuck Schumer getting up in the Senate today, not today, but this week, and making a speech that Trump is not tough enough on North Korea. For goodness sakes, they are part of a party that ruled this country for 8 years and gave the Russians and the North Koreans pretty much everything they wanted. And now suddenly, you're not tough enough. That's not really the Democratic Party position, but they try to sell it to you. I mean, this is an old political technique. It's not new. And they try to identify with people who they really don't identify with just to get the vote at election time.
Right. No, you're right about that. And a good example, I think, of what you're talking about is what's happening down in Florida. Let's talk a little bit about that. This young man, Dave Hogg, I guess that's how you pronounce it, H-O-G-G, he has now become the face of the anti-NRA movement. And they just had a situation down there where there was a retail store. I don't know if it's a single store or a chain of stores. I don't know. But apparently they decided to – this particular store was donating money to candidates. And these young people, this young man decided that he disagreed with that. I mean, up to now, the story is okay. I can disagree with whatever store, you know, who they give money to. I can also choose to take my money somewhere else. So far, so good. But then they decide that they're going to go into the store and they're going to lay down on the store floor and stop people from doing their shopping. Well, that's where we go from having an honest disagreement to just being crazy. And I hope that the people down in Florida really go after that store and say, no, we don't appreciate you can donate money to whoever you want. That's your right. But, you know, don't let these people come in and do that, lay on the floor. And I hope that people really, really fight back, Bill.
I hope they do, too. And I think that if they do, maybe we will see some change. Now, in these corporate entities that suddenly cave in, Starbucks being the worst example. I mean, they just cave into anybody because the head of Starbucks, first of all, is a liberal. And many of these companies, they start these programs. This is not actually all that new. There was a time when Jesse Jackson shook down companies that were accused of racism. You just use the word, and they immediately bring in the race-sensitive trainers. Well, I said I have no problem at all with corporations taking a stand against racism, of course, and a stand in favor of equal opportunity. Absolutely. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about intimidation. That's something very different. And I think many political people are intimidated, many teachers are intimidated, schools are intimidated, and worst of all, parents are intimidated. You hear all the time about parents saying, I don't really like what they're teaching my kids, but if you go in and say anything about it, you're immediately denounced as a racist or as a nationalist or a bigot, and people don't want to get involved. What you have today is really a new age of what we used to call McCarthyism. It is that destruction of people's reputations, the destruction of corporations' reputations, just on the basis of a charge. And it is a very frightening thing. It was frightening back in the early 50s when it was on the other side. But it is even more frightening today because, unfortunately, today, some elements in the press, some elements in the education community are siding with those who are McCarthyistic.
Right. Well, I don't know anything about the store down in Florida. As I said, I don't know if it's a private company or a public company, I don't know.
It's a supermarket chain.
Right. So it's a chain. Okay. So it's probably, I'm guessing it's a public company, although I could be wrong. But it seems to me that there are better ways of really showing your distaste or your disagreement with how a company contributes to campaigns. And I think the issue here is that they're donating money to the fellow who is running for governor. I believe that's what drove all of this or started all of this. And apparently it's because the fellow who's running for governor is also getting money from the NRA. I think that's the connection. But I just think the tactics should be criticized by everybody. And I've said it before on our conversations, Bill, but it seems to me the one person who could make a significant improvement to all of this and really perhaps bring an end to this garbage would be President Obama. If President Obama came out and said, no, don't do it that way. There are other ways of doing it, but don't do it that way. I think he might finally make a positive contribution to the country, Bill.
Well, I agree with you on that, and I think my fear is that deep down, Obama has no problem with these tactics.
Mm.
You know, I've always said that I think Obama is a man who was never vetted properly. He had a press that loved him and still does love him and protects him, never asked him a serious question about anything, and there were very serious questions to ask. And that I don't see any hope there. I would love to see Obama make a statement, for example, to the NFL players and tell them, look, the rules that have been set down are reasonable rules. You know, you're playing on a team on somebody else's field. The fans have come to see a game. But why don't you devote your attention to off-field action on behalf of your communities, and then we could all support you. But he won't say it. He won't say it. I think, you know, this is a man who presided over a Department of Education that became almost fascistic in its rule over schools, over the sexual harassment trials, which deprived the accused of any real basic rights that we give accusers all the time in courtrooms, and he didn't care. This is a man who provided over a highly politicized Department of Justice that really wasn't a Department of Justice and often did far more harm than good. Look at Baltimore. It's a perfect example. And I just don't think he really cares. I think he is a man of the left who is doing the left-wing thing.
Well, and you're right about that, and so maybe we wouldn't expect it from him, but maybe let's say Vice President Biden, who I understand wants to run for president in 2020, maybe he can do it, or any of the Democrats running for president. Again, my expectations are not very high, but it would take somebody from their side, just like President Eisenhower was the one who put down Senator McCarthy, as I understand, Bill. And it has to be somebody from the other party who said,
that's right.
it's just like Senator Lieberman stood up to President Clinton. Somebody from the other side has to put down the flag and say, no, we may be in the same party, but what you're doing is wrong. That's what I like to see from a Democrat, Bill.
Well, and I think you're absolutely correct. It was people forget that it was Republicans who brought down Joe McCarthy. It was not mm-hmm. Democrats. And there were active Republicans, the senator from Maine. What was her name? Well, I've forgotten it from now on. But she was, I think, at that time the only woman in the Senate, and I've forgotten her name. But it has to be somebody from their side who can speak to them. We didn't know until years after his presidency the active role that President Eisenhower took in bringing down McCarthy. Eisenhower was a good strategist, and he knew that the way you bring down a demagogue like McCarthy was to have him destroy himself. And it was Eisenhower who, in many ways, crafted the Army-McCarthy hearings in the early 1950s, where McCarthy had to face Army officers who were decorated, and Eisenhower, I think, calculated that McCarthy would make a fool of himself, which he did, and that would be the beginning of his downfall, which it was. So Eisenhower was active. Some accused him of being a little too cautious in confronting McCarthy publicly, but what he did privately was very effective.
Yes, and in fact, there have been, in that great book that Stephen Ambrose wrote about Eisenhower, he brings that up, how effective he was in bringing down McCarthy. One last thing, Bill, before we take a break. It looks like President Obama is doing quite well. He just signed a big deal with Netflix. I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I hope he makes a lot of money and enjoys a long retirement. And if he wants to be on Netflix, I don't have to buy Netflix. I guess that's my choice. I don't have to buy it. But there's also apparently a donor who made it possible, and apparently not much concern to the media about that, Bill.
Well, there will be never any concern on the part of the media about anything Obama does. This is a terrible situation where the media will not deal with him as you would deal with any other president. You know, I've said many times there is nothing being said about President Trump that was not said about George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. It's the same attitude, the same vicious attacks. You're not legitimate. You're stupid. You shouldn't be president. You have a vice president who's a terrible man, Dick Cheney. It's basically the same thing. The same things were also said about Ronald Reagan, but in mm-hmm. a softer tone because it was a little bit of a softer age. But this is the attitude toward Republicans on the part of the left, that you're terrible people and we must bring you down and we must hate you. And here came this figure out of Illinois, Barack Obama, a man whose resume was basically a blank page. Mm-hmm. But he was articulate, he was educated to some degree, he could present himself to the American people, questions began to be raised by critics, and not one of them was ever addressed by the press. Nothing. I mean, just no vetting of any kind. Now, yes, he's making a fortune. He's making a fortune on his presidency. It's very unseemly. Harry Truman set the standard. He went home to Independence, Missouri. He said, I'm going to put my suitcases up in the closet, and that's it. He never tried to make a dime on his time in office. And that was also true of other presidents. Some made some money on, you know, little things. But this is now becoming an enterprise. He's making millions on his book deals, now millions more on television deals. And I think it's at the very minimum, it's unseemly because he seems to be selling the presidency.
Right, but nobody will ask him the question. This is the part that I mean, no reporter will ask him that question. No reporter will say, you know, isn't this a bit too much for an ex-president? I mean, I know,
yeah.
Remember some of the media just went berserk when President Reagan, I guess, went to somewhere to give a speech in his first year?
Yeah,
Japan. And they all thought that was, my goodness, how horrible is that?
Yes.
But, you know.
Well, anything goes if you're a Democrat. Anything goes if you're a Democrat. And, I mean, now we have new information being added to this seemingly never-ending stream of investigations in Washington. And some of these, the information that is coming out, do raise questions about activities of members of the Obama administration.
Yes.
And yet you find the press to be virtually uninterested. If you can turn on CNN, and I find it increasingly difficult to take the pain. I mean, I have to do it for my work because they are a leading news network. But to turn them on is actually, it's almost physically painful. I'm ready to call 911 just to get medical treatment. And yesterday, I have to say, I want to interject this point because we're talking about the press. I turned on CNN very early in the morning, and they were doing a tribute to John McCain, talking about an HBO documentary, and it enraged me. Even though it was positive towards Senator McCain and about his war hero status, because these are the very same journalists who destroyed McCain in 2008, who wouldn't give him a break. And and now suddenly, oh, he's such a great man. All they're doing is honoring the fact that he criticized Trump.
Right.
And everybody knows what they're doing. He's an opponent of Trump, therefore he's suddenly a wonderful man. And I think John McCain is in many respects a wonderful man, and a great role model, and certainly an American hero. And yes, I think President Trump treated him very badly. I will have to say that. But for goodness sake, the inconsistency, the hypocrisy of praising a man whose campaign you helped destroy, bringing into office Barack Obama, whose service to the country as president I think was very inadequate and very dangerous. But, spare us the hypocrisy. Spare us the hypocrisy.
I agree. No, I agree. We're going to take a little break, Bill. Before we do, though, I want to bring up a couple of things about CNN. You're exactly right. They contributed to a large degree to the election of President Obama by never asking him any tough questions. But there was also some good news about CNN. There's an article that came out saying they're having a heck of a time maintaining an audience of, they're basically averaging less than a million people, which is pretty bad, I mean, compared to the others. And the fellow who wrote the article said that what's interesting is that when you watch MSNBC, I mean, MSNBC is unwatchable. From my standpoint, I cannot watch it. I don't watch it. But at least they're being honest with you up front and saying, we hate Trump, and we're going to spend the entire prime time telling you why we hate this man and why, you know, we think he's going to go to jail in the next 24 hours. So at least they're being honest about where they're coming from. It's like Hannity. I mean, look, if you watch Hannity, you know up front that Hannity is going to support President Trump.
Of course.
What makes CNN unwatchable, Bill, is that they pretend they're honest. They pretend they're unbiased. They're saying,
right.
Well, you know, we're CNN. You know, we're good. And in fact, they're not. And I think that's why a lot of people, I believe, I agree with the article. I think a lot of people are tuning them out because they're saying, come on, you guys are not even being honest. At least the other guys are telling us they hate Trump or they love Trump, and you pretend to be to be unbiased. Let me take a little break, Bill, and we'll be back. We have a lot to get into, President Trump, North Korea, and quite a few other things. We're going to touch with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Right now, though, I want you to hear from my other good friend here in Dallas, Carlos Guedes.
This is Carlos Guedes Harpist. I would like to see you guys this Saturday night at Sissiki's at the Star, located at 6765 Winning Drive in Frisco. I'll be performing instrumental high-energy music at 6:30 until 9:30 p.m. Make your reservation today at 972-377-2276. Remember, Sissiki's at the Star is the place to hang out on Saturday night. For upcoming dates, look for me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And we have a link to all of that on the show description. Right under the show description, you'll see a link to Carlo's schedule. Let's get back to our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, I want to take just a quick second here and talk about what happened in Ireland. They approved abortion in what had traditionally been one of the most conservative Catholic countries in the world. And you know, I guess they're going the way of many other European countries on that issue. But what I found fascinating was the reaction of the people. I mean, you had some women saying, I've been waiting all my life for this. Another woman saying, my gosh, we're finally free. Bill, I watched those reactions, and I guess, I mean, I'm personally against abortion, but still, I watched those reactions, and it just doesn't square with me that somebody would say, I have been waiting all my life for the right to have an abortion. I don't get that, Bill. I don't know what your reaction was.
My reaction was the same as yours. And look, abortion is it's a bad thing. Even I've always said that my views on abortion are very conflicted. On the one hand, I think that the position of the church on the sanctity of life is correct. On the other hand, women have always had abortions, and if they're going to have them, I want them to at least be safe. So it's a conflicted position. But abortion is not a good thing, and it has to coarsen the society. I think it has to coarsen our view of life. In addition, it is something that ultimately must fade away because of medical progress. You know, in Europe, interestingly enough, including the so-called progressive countries of Europe, they've been going in the other direction. They've become increasingly restrictive on abortion, and one of the reasons is simply medical progress. That you could, medicine can now save a fetus much earlier time than it did previously. At some point, they may be able to save a fetus that is a month or two old. What do you do in a situation like that? You take a medical professional who is sworn to preserve life and say, end that life because I want it ended. Well, on the other hand, the feminist say it's her body, you know, and she can do with her body what she wishes. I am hopeful that the trend downward in abortion will continue, as it is as it is in this country. And I am hoping also that, and again, you have another medical development that I think has had a dramatic effect, which is sonograms, and the fact that they're now practically photographic, that when people see it's a living thing, they will at least be paused to think about the view of abortion in society and its place in society. And I hope we will go in a more pro-life direction. I can't say that I'm optimistic it'll be eliminated completely or that there'll be any great change in the law. I don't think there will be. But I think action on the part of people themselves over time may go a long way toward solving this problem.
Well, I hope so.
And I think also the fact that we have become an abortion society, not through actions by a legislature or by actions of the people, but by a court decision. And that really has always bothered me because this is a social and moral issue, and courts should not be deciding those issues.
Right, and at least in that respect, they did it correctly in Ireland. They had a vote.
Yes.
They had a referendum, and people voted. That's fine. So at least they had a referendum. Also, people need to remember that this abortion is only acceptable in the first 12 weeks of the pregnancy. So in that sense, they're restricting abortion. So that, you know, that is, I think, better than just unconditional abortion rights. But I have to confess, I just found the reaction of people to be a little bizarre. almost as if Ireland had just won its independence or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't
yeah.
know. I just found it. I just found it in that sense a little bizarre. Well, let's talk a little bit about President Trump and North Korea, Bill. Apparently, I still think this is going to happen, and I think it's going to happen because North Korea needs it to happen more than President Trump. But it is good to see an American president, especially in contrast to his predecessor, an American president who says, I will walk away if I don't have what I need. And that's,
yeah.
To me, that's refreshing, because if you remember President Obama, he went out of his way to get the Cuba deal, the Iran nuclear deal,
and get
nothing for it, exactly. And so it's refreshing when a U.S. president says, you know what, we've got these conditions, and if you don't meet them, we're not going to get together, Bill.
That's exactly right. Well, I think he once said, maybe I'm wrong on this, maybe he was talking about somebody else saying it, but you have to have, in any negotiation, you have to have your chair halfway out and be ready to leave, and you have to send that signal to the other guy that you're not going to accept just anything. I mean, the classic example is Reagan at Reykjavik, when he turned down a Soviet arms control proposal. He said it's not good enough, and the Russians were shocked, just shocked that he would do this, but he did it, and that was, many people say that was the moment the Cold War was over. The Russians realized they were never going to win, not against that president. And I think that Trump, with all his faults, and we have gone through his faults many times here, that with all his faults, he's a man who knows how to do things. He gets them done. He may get them done in a rough manner. He may get them done in a manner that is more like a New York real estate salesman than a traditional American president, but he gets them done. You know, I've been reminded in the last few weeks, the idea I don't think is original with me, about the fact that what we're really seeing with Trump is a Ulysses S. Grant moment. You'll recall during the Civil War when Grant became the head of the Union armies, and he had been a failure in life. He had gone to West Point, left the army, failed at everything, came back into the army to fight the Civil War, rose quickly in the ranks because he just had a natural instinct as a soldier. And people came to him and said, Mr. President, this man, General Grant is a drunkard. He gets drunk. And you know Lincoln's famous reply. He said, whatever he drinks, send him a case. You know, saying in effect, I don't care if he drinks. And then he said, I need this man fights. And Lincoln's problem had been with commanding generals, beginning with McClellan, who really were not very good generals. They may have been good training officers, as McClellan was, but they just didn't seem to know how to fight the Civil War. Grant was brutal, but Grant, among others, won the war for him, and William Tecumseh Sherman as well. That's what was needed. And you have to, at times, make a choice. It's a tough choice between people who are preeners like Obama and who seem so just wonderful, who speak so well, and who seem so highly motivated, and another guy on the other side who will get the job done and protect you. And I think we are in that kind of a moment. It's a Ulysses S. Grant moment, and I think the American people slowly are coming to the realization they know exactly what they have in Trump. It's hard to avoid it. He's a coarse man, a man who says things at times that can be very enraging, but they see this man getting the job done. And
right.
I think that's what they appreciate.
I think you're right. And I'll speak for myself. I mean, as you know, I was not a supporter of President Trump in the primaries. I really wasn't at all. And a lot of it had to do with his personality that I found offensive. But I said, you know, when I went to vote on election day, it was an awful choice, I felt, having to choose between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. But the reason I was willing to vote for then Donald Trump, now President Trump, was because I felt that at the very least he would be surrounded by different people than Hillary Clinton. And we're seeing a little bit of that here, where we see the influence of Secretary Pompeo, where we see the influence of Secretary Mathis, John Bolton. It seems to me he's listening to different people that Hillary Clinton would have been listening to, Bill. And that, I think, in many ways, as I say, his personality, the tweets and all that kind of stuff sometimes get on my nerves. But I look at the bottom line. The bottom line is he's winning many of these battles. And I wish that President Obama had done that to Raul Castro and said, no, we're not going to open an embassy just because You want me to. You need to do something in return, like
yes,
we're seeing
right.
here with North Korea, Bill.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, the president represents the American people. You know, at the end of World War II, when we decided, when President Truman made the decision to use the atomic bomb, there was a debate inside the U.S. government, I mean, on what he should do among the very few people who knew about this. And I think it was the Attorney General, Biddle, I think it was, again, I have to be very careful about memory, who said to him, because there was anguish over what the casualties would be, and he said to him, Mr. President, you were not elected Emperor of Japan. You were elected President of the United States. And Biddle said, if you do not go ahead and use this to end the war, I will see you at your impeachment trial. And I think it was a jolting moment. Trump was elected and took the oath as President of the United States, not as President of the world. His first obligation is to the American people, and he understands it. I mean, yes, he sometimes says things in an outlandish way and exaggerates and uses adjectives far too much, but he understands what his role as president is right now and what he must do. I know there are people who, even if this summit goes ahead, who are ridiculing him already. He doesn't understand how difficult this is. He doesn't understand the complications and how much time you need to prepare and to go to your professionals and do this and do that. And as one commentator said, he doesn't understand compared to who? Compared to what? To Obama?
That's right. That's
who
right.
failed at everything. All the people you see on television now criticizing him are failures, are people who
yes.
didn't get the job done. And they say, well, they're more interested in the process. You know, they're interested in whether when on their first night in Singapore in the negotiations, whether the dinner menu is prepared correctly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's that kind of mentality. The people who are obsessed by process and never by results. I like results. It reminds me of the...
Too.
Yeah, it reminds me of the attitude toward Rudy Giuliani. No matter, you know, he's a tough guy, Rudy. But when Rudy was mayor, he got the job done. And crime
mm-hmm.
did go down dramatically. And people panicked. You should have, I can remember it, the panic on
sure.
the left and the panic among journalists. How dare you solve a problem? I mean, didn't you learn you don't solve them? You do it. You do things with style. If you want to solve the crime problem, you come to
right.
us. We will introduce you to a proper sociologist who will tell you about the 20 meetings that must take place before you do anything. You know, it's also said in wartime that many of the most effective actions in war are conducted by young soldiers because they don't fully understand the risk. And
mm-hmm.
and I forgot what general who said if they ever understood what it was like, they'd never do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes going in with a fresh look at a situation, not always, can work very well. And I think Trump knows how to limit his losses if there are losses.
You know, Bill, the other day I was thinking of President Trump's ways of doing things, and they kind of remind me a little bit of Belichick, you know, the Patriots coach. What's his name?
Yes.
I can't think of his first.
I think it's Bob.
Yeah, Belichick, yeah, or
yes.
whatever the coach is, who is actually an extremely difficult person to work for, a man who changes things almost daily. I mean, other than the quarterback, I think he's just about turned over the team so many times. I would think probably a lot of his critics would say he's a bit chaotic. But
yes.
every NFL owner would love to have that kind of chaos. You know, the
yes,
guy has won
right.
5 Super Bowls, and he's been in 9 Super Bowls. And I think to some extent I'm beginning to think that President Trump is that way. We had a coach here with the Cowboys who succeeded Tom Landry, who was sort of the same way, you know, kind of chaotic and would say things to the media and would challenge the – I mean, the guy was not very diplomatic, but he won 2 Super Bowls. And sometimes I'm beginning to think that a lot of Americans are doing exactly what you said a few minutes ago. They're not, you know, they tune out what he says and they just look at what he does. And
yes.
and that's kind of, I think that's the reason people are beginning to like him. They may not love the guy. He's probably not the guy you want your daughter to marry. I'll put it that way.
No. Yes.
But my goodness, I mean, he may be the guy you want running your business. If the business gets in trouble. So, you know, it's an interesting, I don't think we've ever had, at least in recent years, a guy like that, who's a deal maker, he's a gets things done, And you may not love what he does or what people are saying about him, but when you get the mutual funds report, they're doing better than they were before, Bill.
That's right. And, you know, I'm reminded of Lincoln's comment on Grant, this man fights. And that's what people like about him.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And he has produced results for the average American. You know
well,
I mean?
That he's done. No, that he's done. You're exactly right. If you're an average American today, you feel better. And that shows up in every poll. Now, one of the things about President Trump is that he's very effective at fighting back. And he's created now this thing called Spygate. You got to hand it to the guy. He knows how to fight back. If only President Bush had shown some of this in year 6 and year 7 of his presidency, maybe he would have been able to fight back the hypocritical attacks that he had to deal with when it came to Iraq. But Spygate is an interesting scandal, Bill, because maybe they weren't spying, but they clearly had somebody in there. And either way, it's not a good thing, Bill.
No, it's not. And I think that the press is not taking it seriously enough. Trump may very well have exaggerated some of his concerns about it, but he did make a very good point in one of his tweets, and government by tweet, it's not necessarily the best way of doing it, but he said Obama never showed any concern about this. And that what they're trying to do, obviously, in the Trump White House is to move the responsibility for some of these strange goings-on toward the president. I think toward President Obama. I think it will not be very long before we hear the words, what did the president know and when did he know it? Which was the question asked, you remember, at Watergate. And it was asked by Republicans of Nixon, just as it was asked by Democrats. What did the president know and when did he know it? And I think it could turn out to be a very dicey thing for Obama. There are reports, again, just reports, we haven't had things confirmed, that this FBI probe of the Trump campaign was discussed in the Obama White House. Well, if that's true, that's dangerous. That's a dangerous situation. Did the Obama White House sponsor or wink at putting operatives or observers in the Trump campaign? The question I have that I would like to see asked is, isn't the Secret Service tasked with protecting the president? And if the FBI felt, as they seem to be saying now, that there was some concern about attempts to infiltrate the Trump campaign by the Russians, wouldn't the Secret Service be notified and told we have a problem and you may want to watch some of these people? I would imagine that would be done. I can't imagine it not being done. But we have no report of it being done. I'd like to hear that question asked. Given the state of the press today and the belief in the divinity of Barack Obama, you don't get many questions asked. You really don't. I mean,
don't. And Bill, it's only a matter of time. By the way, I think the fellow who came up with that line, what did the president know? Well, I think it was Howard Baker, Senator Howard Baker.
Who was
at the time. That's right. And I've always been saying, where is the Democrat Howard Baker when it comes to all these scandals? It would be nice to have a Democrat. But you know what's going to happen, Bill? If they ask the president, what did you know and when did you know it? You know that somebody on the Democrat side is going to say, probably somebody from the Black Congressional Caucus is going to say, you know what? No president was ever put through this before. No president was ever put. Of course, Nixon was, but they'll forget that. But they'll start asking those questions that somehow they'll be suggesting that it's all about race. You know, it's all about race that they're asking these. And that is sad because it's not about race. I could care less what skin color Barack. I got over Barack Obama's skin color the day he announced his presidency. That's okay. He's black. Great. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. We have a black man running. Now, what does he stand for? So I got over
that's
his race color right away. And I haven't been thinking about his race color since, or color of race, or skin color, since he declared his candidacy. I'm listening to him as a man, because that's what I do. I look at your character. I don't look at your skin color, Bill.
That's exactly right. And look, I have no doubt that there are some racists out there. Of course there are. There always will be. But the great majority of the American people demonstrated by electing Obama.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And what is so remarkable about that is that many of these people in the Midwest then turned around and voted for Donald Trump, and they're being called racist, even though they voted for Obama. I mean, it gets crazy. It's like the standard word you have to insert into the conversation. You know, who's a racist today? Oh, well, here's a list. Here we have a list here. And I'm afraid that's the way it works in American politics today. But it is getting closer and closer to Obama. There was a columnist this week who said, let's impeach the president, the past one. And the question is actually being asked in a few circles, small circles to be sure, can you impeach a former president? And apparently the answer is yes, you can impeach and then try him, but you can't remove him from office because he isn't in office.
Right.
But you can apparently prevent him from ever holding a federal office again. But, you know, we forget the fact that Bill Clinton, who was impeached and was exonerated by the Senate, is also a disbarred lawyer as a result
That's
of
right.
those proceedings. So there
well,
are,
that
there
could happen
punishment.
To President Obama. President Obama could lose his license. I don't know if
I don't
he practices.
Think he has a, that's an interesting question because I don't think he has a license.
I don't know either. I don't know that he ever was a practicing attorney in Chicago, but I know he was a community organizer. But another point I wanted to make sure we get into this one before we run out of time, but James Clapper has been in the news, and you wrote an interesting post about Michael Hayden and James Clapper having a few disagreements, Bill.
Yes, they were part of the Obama administration, although in fairness I should point out I think both of them did also serve in the Bush administration and previous administrations because both of them were military officers. But Clapper has been making – he's a Trump hater, and he's been making some wild statements about Trump. And Hayden, who usually is very critical of Trump, said Clapper doesn't know what he's talking about. He shouldn't be making these statements. And that's rare that two Obamans go at each other. Now, they're usually pretty much in lockstep. But I think that may increase if more revelations come out that are embarrassing to Obama.
Right.
Whether they will come out, I don't know. I mean, I think we're moving in that direction. But, you know, I could easily see a grand deal being made privately toward the end of the Mueller investigation. You lay off Trump and we'll lay off Obama. These things would not be a formal agreement, but they could be a kind of wink and nod type situation. Because I think the American people are getting tired of these endless investigations. I mean, they go on and on and on. The president was elected to serve. If he's got a case against him, present your case. Now, in Watergate, a crime was committed. That we knew.
Right.
And it had to be investigated. Here, we don't know anything. We really, and at the end of a year or so of Mueller, we really don't know much of anything.
The problem.
Not only isn't there a smoking gun, there isn't a gun. I mean, it's not smoking. It's never been loaded. No one ever saw it. And it would be nice if somebody would come up with something.
That's right. Looking at next week, Bill, obviously the Congress comes back and there's always something going on. But one of the most interesting things, and you wrote a post about this as well, is that Nancy Pelosi has now become the Republicans' meal ticket to keep the House. It seems like the more that they say that she could be the next speaker, it might actually help the Democrats if they said, you know, she's leaving office after this term. And so there is no chance whatsoever that she'll be back and no chance whatsoever that she will be the speaker. Now, they may have a hard time explaining that to Mrs. Pelosi, but that may be – it's just fascinating how she is so controversial that she actually increases turnout by just the thought that she would be a speaker, Bill.
Well, apparently, yes. I mean, she has this image that is kind of like Attila the Hun or something like that. And she's not exactly effective at press conferences.
Not anymore.
She can't remember anything. I think she remembers who the president is. And she said, you know, I've met Mr. Lincoln many times. And she really – and the interesting thing is that she is actually a symbol of the more rational part of the Democratic Party. of the more moderate part of the Democratic Party. Pelosi is not actually an extremist. She's you know, a liberal. I don't agree with her on a lot of things, but she's not an extremist. But the people who are trying to take over the party in her stead really are extremists. And isn't it interesting that to the general public they see Pelosi as a monster? She is a semi-monster. She's kind of a little monster. The big monsters are the ones who are
right.
trying to depose her. So you have a very bad situation in the Democratic Party, because if they do get rid of Pelosi, looking at the poll numbers, who do they bring in as a replacement? You know, Lenin is dead, but they'll try to revive him.
Right.
You look at who the head. I mean, the Democratic Party in California is essentially a Marxist party.
Mm-hmm.
They want to bring down the base of the party wants to bring down Dianne Feinstein, who I think will be reelected anyway. They want to get rid of just about the entire group in California that would be called reasonable, or at least within reason, you know, reasonable liberals, and they want real extreme action.
They're crazy out there, and
it's been going on for years.
But it's interesting, though, because they're so crazy out there that they may have actually hurt themselves, because we could probably talk about this the next time, because
yes.
they've created this primary system. Now they're all panicking
mm-hmm.
because they may end up creating a primary system that actually ends up benefiting the Republican Party. But we're
yes.
just about out of time, Bill. As always, I want to thank you for your time and the time that you chat with us and the great work that you do at Urgent Agenda. And
Thank you. You
said, let's observe Memorial Day, and I'm sure next week we'll have a lot to get into. We always do, Bill.
There's plenty happening in the world. There is no relief.
No, there isn't. It'd be nice once in a while to have a week off from all of this very intense politics, but I don't think that can happen I think the Internet has made intensity a way of life, Bill.
Oh, there's no question about it. It's the Internet and the 24-hour news cycle.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You can't get away from it. And, of course, the fact that you can get all this on a smartphone. It's with you all the time. I mean, when we
exactly.
were growing up, for goodness sake, if we wanted to know what was happening in the world, we'd have to go home, turn on a TV, wait till 7 o'clock at night when there was a news program.
Or wait for the next morning's paper in many
right.
places. I mean,
that's
how many
right.
times did we wake up to find out that something dramatic had happened the night before? And
oh,
yet
absolutely.
Today you find out instantly. I mean, you know, news alert, you know, something happened here and there. But anyway, Bill, have a wonderful day. Great observation of Memorial Day. And thank you, as always, for your time. It's always a great honor to chat with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Silvio, and I look forward to our next show.
Thank you so much. Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. You need to follow Urgent Agenda. It's really a great resource of information. And Bill kind of puts it all together with his comments and summaries. Just absolutely wonderful. If you're not doing it, do it. I think you're going. And we have a link to his website, by the way, on the show information. Well, have a wonderful observation of Memorial Day, and we'll talk to you the next time. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.